From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. My guest this week, James R. Hansen, is the author of First Man, The Life of Neil Armstrong, the authorized biography of the first man to walk on the moon. He's also the co-author of a new book. It's called Forever Young, A Life of Adventure in Air and Space by John W. Young. John Young, now 82, flew 2 Gemini missions, 2 Apollo missions, and 2 space shuttle missions. James Hansen, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much, Gary.
Dr. Hansen, how did you get to be the astronaut's best friend?
Well, I had spent quite a few years in my career writing about aerospace before I did anything with astronauts. In 2000, I decided I wanted to do an astronaut biography, and looking around, Armstrong's hadn't been done, and of course, of all the astronauts, he's the one that people would be most interested in. So I had a contact in NASA, Neil. Wasn't easy to find Neil's address, and so I wrote him and told him what I'd like to do, and he wrote me back kind of a polite refusal and said he was too busy at the time, maybe later. And I didn't. I sort of let it go for a while, and then I sent him a group of books that I had written. One was I had helped an engineer write his life story, and I think it was that one that convinced Neil that I would treat his technical life seriously. So it became, I ended up getting Armstrong's authorization to do the biography, and it came out in 2005. And after that occurred, I had a few other people interested in me getting involved in book projects, including John Young, who, of course, is the same, as you said, I think the same age as Neil. He's 82, and his story is a phenomenal one in terms of being the longest one of all the astronauts, spending 40 years with NASA, and so he was writing his own memoir, and after it was finished, the first few readers of the memoir in the manuscript thought, this could use a little help. and so the family contacted me and asked me if I'd take a look at it, and I wrote back a fairly long set of suggestions, and I guess that set my fate right there. As soon as they saw what they said, he seems to know what needs to be done to the book. So I got involved and worked with John for about a year and a half to get the manuscript to what it is today. So it was interesting for me to do a biography of Armstrong and then work on an autobiography where I had to, essentially, the writing had to stay in the same voice. I mean, it's John telling his story, and I'm just there as an author to help him tell it better.
And it really is in his voice. I mean, it really felt like he was talking to me. Did you record a lot of conversations with him?
Well, I used a lot of recordings that had been made by other people. Unfortunately, by some months into the project, John's health had deteriorated quite a bit, and he really wasn't able to work as actively with me as I had hoped. But I did have a lot of transcripts of other interviews that he had done, and so I incorporated those as much as I could. Of course, when I wrote something that was really original material with me, and I was writing it, as John Young, I would send it back, and he and his wife would look over it carefully and make sure it was, it passed muster. Susie, his wife, feels like I really kept things very close to John. You can't tell much difference. I'm glad that she and others think it's pretty seamless in terms of the voice, given the role that I did.
There are some little things, the way he talks. I mean, yeah. I've never talked to him, but it sounds like a person talking. In fact, it sounds like an astronaut talking.
Yeah, John had his, I think of all the astronauts, he maybe had the most wicked sense of humor. And, of course, that's saying something because a number of them did. And he, of course, became somewhat legendary. He stayed around NASA long enough, and he was chief of the astronaut corps. And his criticism of NASA after the Challenger accident and again after Columbia, he was not the most popular person with some NASA folks, but with others, I mean, if you go to Johnson Space Center, I mean, there are people who just felt like still feel that John walked on water.
Oh, and I want to talk about all that stuff, but you know, he's got this reputation, and there's a website devoted to him called Badass, which I think is pretty funny. And you know, he's had this incredible career that you know, he flew the greatest test flight in history when he flew the first space shuttle, and he walked on the moon. And yet, you know, when you say Neil Armstrong, everybody goes, "Oh yeah, Neil Armstrong." And
right.
You say John Young, people go, "Who's that?"
Yeah, it's really unfortunate that that's the case. I mean, not that Neil doesn't deserve all the attention that he got, and his death really, I mean, it really hit me hard. I attended all the memorial services, and I spoke at one of them in Huntsville, and I'm still grieving losing Neil. But you know, John, and I felt a little bit unfortunate that John's book came out almost as Neil's death occurred, and as if it was taking, you know, I didn't really want the attention taken away from John's book, but on the other hand, you know, what can you say when Armstrong has passed away?
Well, it seems to me that the death of Neil Armstrong just reawakens people's interest in the story, so that's probably good for the book.
Yeah, it probably is, and John, again, it's the name is just, even though he did, you know, he did two Apollo flights, and he did two Gemini flights, and he was that first shuttle commander, and he was head of the astronaut office. He never really did the truly iconic, you know, really, he never really captured the iconic moment. The cover of the book is John jumping and saluting, and it's a very iconic picture. But by Apollo 16, you know, the TV audience around the world is, you know, maybe a tenth of what it had been the night that Apollo 11 landed, if that much. And so a lot of some really remarkable spacewalking and John driving the lunar rover like a bat out of hell over the moon's surface, which he really was doing, that a lot of that was missed by the public at large. So it was... If you live in the Orlando area, you ride the John Young Parkway, so the name is known there, but I'm not sure that most people that drive around Orlando would even know what the connection is. John actually lived as a teenager in the College Park neighborhood of Orlando. His father was an engineer who worked for one of the large Florida citrus growers, and so they moved down there when he was in his early teens. He always had some great one-liners. He's famous for his flight with Gus Grissom, the first Gemini manned flight, when he smuggled a corned beef sandwich up in the spacecraft, which really, I mean, you'd think that wouldn't cause a whole lot of trouble, but there was really a congressional investigation into how in the world, you know, the astronaut could smuggle, you know, a corned beef sandwich. And I've heard John talk about that, and he has some, you know, really good lines about it. But it's funny, in the book, it's a real interesting thing about the book. When I first read the manuscript, he didn't have anything about the corned beef sandwich in you know, covering that Gemini flight. And I told him, I said, "John, everybody knows about the corned beef sandwich." And he said, "Too much has been made of it. You know, it takes too much attention away from, you know, from what that mission really accomplished." And I said, "Well, I understand that point, but, you know, still, everybody that's going to pick up that book is going to want to hear what you have to say about the corned beef sandwich, where it came from, and so forth." Actually, Wally Schirra was the one that was the real villain. He's the one that got the sandwich from a local deli and gave it to John. And so Schirra deserves more of the blame than John in some respects.
And I think all the readers will want to know why there was no pickle and no mustard.
Right, exactly.
The book, which by the way is called Forever Young: A Life of Adventure in Air and Space by John W. Young and my guest James R. Hansen. It's not just a biography of John Young. In fact, it's not a biography of John Young, autobiography, because he doesn't tell you anything about anything other than his life in space. He doesn't.
Yeah, you know, I tried hard. It's funny, when you deal with these astronauts, it was true with Armstrong, too. It's like, You know, they just, what you want to do is get them on a psychiatrist's sofa, you know, and have, you know, months and months of therapy with them. And they just don't want to talk about, I mean, Neil couldn't have written an autobiography. I mean, he just could not have written about himself. And John wrote his like a technical report. I mean, the book is much different than the original manuscript. Because I tried hard to get, you know, John's spirit and sense of humor. But he doesn't talk a whole lot about his private life. One thing that I brought in that he wasn't, I guess he didn't oppose it, but you know, John as a boy one night when they were living in Orlando, some domestic difficulties arose in the house, and the mother was taken away in a straitjacket and was taken to Tallahatchie Mental Hospital in the Panhandle of Florida, and John and his brother never saw her again, ever. And this was not, I mean, this was a huge event in his life. But that's something Don didn't write about, didn't really want to talk about. I knew about it from talking to his wife, Susie, and I felt like there had to be something in the book about that. And so there is, but, you know, I would like there to be more of the private story of John, you know, in the book. But as I said, these guys are so, you know, so used to just focusing on their jobs and on the technical side that it's, you know, they just have a very hard time talking about themselves.
What is in the book is almost an entire history of the space program, because it goes all the way back to the beginning.
Yeah.
And comes all the way up to the current time. You know, when I was a kid, I used to love to get up in the morning and watch the, sit with Walter Cronkite and watch the launches of Gemini and Apollo. I was enthralled by that whole space thing. And I just took it for granted that it would always be a part of our lives, that it was sort of the coming of the future. You know, the life that I saw in the Jetsons would only come if we continued to travel in space. And now, you know, there's generations of Americans who have no memory of it or were not alive when it happened. And as you and John point out in your book, you know, in just a few years, there'll be nobody to even remember the moonwalk.
Right.
So is it all over? Or is it?
You know, I'm speaking for myself. I guess I've been influenced so much by my conversations with people like Armstrong and Young. I don't think they feel that it's over. I think they just feel it's taking a hiatus. I think they feel, and I do as well, that it's kind of in humankind's nature to explore, you know, the things that had to come together for Kennedy to make the lunar commitment and for that Apollo program to happen. I mean, you know, there had to be a confluence of all kinds of unusual circumstances that allowed that. And whether it's going to take some kind of convergence of things like that again, I don't know. I mean, I think one of the problems that we've had in the space program is it's kind of the, you know, Kennedy syndrome, as if, you know, the only way we make big steps in space is to get a big presidential commitment behind it. And that's not, it was great for going to the moon, but then then nothing happened afterwards. There wasn't a cumulative effect the way everybody thought. They thought that, you know, the next logical step would be a space station and a shuttle together, and we'd be off to Mars by now. And I think it's all going to happen. It's going to happen in ways that none of the pioneers really conceived of it. If you go back and read what von Braun wrote in Collier's magazine back in the 50s, you know, he had it all laid out and where a space station would actually be the first thing you do. You know, you build up your experience in Earth orbit, and then you move out from Earth orbit to the moon and from the moon beyond. And that's the logical way that you know, exploration maybe should have taken place. But the space race and the competition with the Russians, you know, made us leapfrog over the space station. Once we leaped over it, it was hard to go back and actually do it. So I think it's, you know, we're doing different things than we imagined we'd be doing now. I mean, I'm very impressed with, you know, with the rovers on Mars and a lot of our unmanned missions. We've got a new space telescope that's going to go out that's going to be, you know, even much more incredible than Hubble. And we've done some really amazing things, Voyager, and it's just not going to be quite the way. And it's not going to be the continuous human presence in our space program as we might have imagined back in the 60s.
Well, that's all cool, but it's not as cool as, you know, walking on the moon. But, you know, in your book, you and John Young argue that a space program could be the answer to our economic woes. That is, it would put so many people to work and would generate, you know, labor.
Well, even more than that, the last part of the epilogue of the book is entitled When Worlds Collide, which is taken after the famous science fiction novel of the 1930s that both John and I liked a lot. John believes that we need, you know, we need to go back to the moon and we need a space program in order for us to survive as a species, because there are threats to planet Earth. I remember hearing him at his talk in Houston, and the whole speech that luncheon was about the asteroid threat. And, you know, I think half the people in the audience thought, you know, this guy's kind of a kook, you know, talking about this is just Hollywood science fiction stuff. Sure, there's
Chicken Little.
But this isn't, you know, it's so, the chances are so remote. Well, as I looked into it more and talked to John more and read what John had been reading, I mean, the assessments, the technical assessments from very, very solid professional organizations like the American Institute for Aeronautics and Astronautics and the European Space Agency and the Space Guard Foundation and even NASA, the asteroid threat is real. John was telling me in particular, and we put it into the book, in March of 1989, there was an asteroid the size of an aircraft carrier that intersected the orbit of the Earth at exactly the place the Earth had been 6 minutes earlier. And if that had hit, it would have been, I mean, whether it would have been a total Armageddon, but it would have been a disaster, you know, of, you know, maybe comparable to, you know, what happened with the dinosaurs. I mean, and these things are being, these near-Earth objects or NEOs are being plotted in their location. And John feels that, you know, we have to be, to survive as a species, we need to be a multi-planet civilization. And he also thinks we need to go back to the moon, because at the moon we can, in a sense, create a planetary offense system, that we can develop technologies on the moon that would help us if we ever do have the kind of disastrous impact of an asteroid. And we have essentially like a nuclear cloud over the Earth, and we're losing our power, ability for electric power. John believes that by developing the moon industrially, which of course is very controversial with people, but he feels that developing those technologies will allow us to rebuild civilization on Earth if something like this occurs. So his justification for space, you know, really is, It isn't so much the economic one, it's the survival. I mean, he believes that really we need to go out into space because we're not going to survive forever on this one planet.
Well, Dr. Hansen, you and John Young in your book say that it's more likely that I will get killed by an asteroid than I will in a plane crash.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And that's something that was in a technical paper that John showed to me. So it's not original to us.
Dr. Hansen, your book, Forever Young, discusses many dangerous moments in space that John Young faced while traveling in space. The spacewalk on his second Gemini flight, for example.
Yeah, well, that was maybe more of a danger for Collins than it was for Mike Collins, who was his pilot on that flight. Spacewalks. It's one thing that we didn't really maybe know very well when it was happening, but spacewalks were very, very dangerous to be doing, and I mean, and they had to be prepared. I mean, when Collins was out there, getting an astronaut back in was into these. I mean, Gemini spacecraft is a two-person spacecraft, and it's, if you've ever seen one in a museum, you can't believe two people even could get in there. And you got these, you know, you've got these bulky spacesuits, and you've got him trying to float back in. And if if the astronaut could not get back in, there was no choice. I mean, Young and the others who would have been in those situations, they just would have to shut the door, clip off the umbilical, and let their crewmate go flying. I mean, there was no other choice.
Wow.
They had to, once they were out, they had to get them back in, and it was never easy to do. Ed White was the first American space flight, and it was very, very dicey.
Yeah. And I guess a lot of the dicey things happened, and we didn't even know about it. They didn't tell it. Walter Cronkite didn't tell us about all the dicey stuff.
Well, there were a lot of filters before it got to Walter, and there were things that NASA didn't want people to know, didn't even want, the families to know in some cases. During Gemini 8, when Armstrong and Dave Scott have an emergency when a thruster gets stuck open on their spacecraft, and they have to quickly, unfortunately they're able to resolve the motions, but they have to come back quickly. Janet Armstrong, was the wife of Neil at the time. She had these black boxes. The families had these black boxes that NASA had provided so they could follow the mission control narrative of what's going on. And when the problem occurred with Gemini 8, the box went off. She couldn't hear anymore. So she drove down to Johnson Space Center to find out what was going in, and she was blocked. She was blocked from going in, and she was one mad lady. I interviewed her about this, and she made it clear when she told Deke Slayton, who was chief of the astronaut corps then, that was unacceptable, and if that ever happened again, she was going to the press. So there were filters not only for media, but there were filters even for family in terms of some of the things that were going on.
That was when Neil Armstrong was spinning out of control, and I guess if it had continued to spin, they would have lost consciousness, and we would have lost the astronauts.
And boy, if we had had two dead astronauts orbiting the Earth in 1966,
that might have ended the space program. What would have happened?
I mean, it was bad enough we almost ended Apollo when the launch pad fire killed Grissom and White and Chafee. But to have dead astronauts and orbiting the Earth would have been just beyond horrible.
Hearing the story of Apollo 1 from John Young, who was a good friend of Gus Grissom's and the other men involved, it's really a moving part of your book. But I want to ask you about, sometimes the filters that are designed to keep things, good for the public don't always work. What about when John Young's hot mic on the moon? What about that story?
Yeah, well, sometimes the astronaut is caught up in the moment and doesn't even care that the mic is left open, and so certain things get said.
I got the farts again. I've got them again, Charlie. I haven't eaten this much citrus fruit in 20 years. Can I tell you one thing? In another 12 fucking days, I ain't never eaten any more. I put them up over the, right up in there. They ain't there? Orion, Houston?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I'm down here. Will you have my hot mic? How long we had that?
Yeah.
That's one of the interesting things about the astronauts, the way they're so low key. In Apollo 13, when Jim Lovell said we're venting something out into space, and they said yes, Roger, we copy your venting, instead of going
right
our air and we're dying.
They never
get crazy. What? How do they master that?
Well, the way I understand it is that these guys, you have to go back through their entire careers. I mean, thinking about Armstrong and Young, for example, I mean, these guys were naval aviators that were landing, that were in combat and were flying, advanced aircraft onto aircraft carriers, when they were 19 to 20 years old. And they go from there to being test pilots, flying some of the most advanced high-speed, high-altitude aircraft. And I mean, that was in terms of the number of deaths that occur in the test pilot community, it's much, much more significant than with anything that's happened in space and with astronauts. It's just incredible that over the course of many years, they had faced, danger so many times that they just become. I mean, it's not that they become that they're naive or they're just deluded into thinking that they're immortal. They're not, but they feel if they're prepared, if they've been trained and they're prepared and they know their spacecraft and or aircraft and they know what they're supposed to do, that they feel they can make it through. You know, and that's how they did it. I think it was just a really strong sense of professionalism with a lot of experience behind it.
And I guess that's why I was surprised in your book when John Young tells us that Buzz Aldrin was, he says it very politely, but not very well liked.
Yeah, he wasn't. I mean, and there were a number of astronauts that I've interviewed that will tell you that. I mean, Neil might have been the only commander that would have worked really well with Buzz. And maybe that's the reason they were matched up. I mean, when I interviewed Frank Borman out in New Mexico, and Frank's very crusty fellow. I like Frank a lot, but Frank told me flat out that he wouldn't take Aldrin as a crewmate. He had told Deke, no, not going to take anybody but Buzz. So Buzz, Buzz was called Dr. Rendezvous around the astronaut office back in the 60s because he had done a doctorate in orbital rendezvous mechanics at MIT, and he was very proud of it, as maybe he should have been. But the term Dr. Rendezvous was not meant in a good way. when his fellow astronauts were referring to Dr. Rendezvous, they were usually saying it behind his back.
Sarcastically.
Yes, absolutely.
what about his, I'm asking about John Young now, about his relationship with his moon landing partner, Charlie Duke. Did they stay friends after coming back from the moon? Did they stay?
Yeah, I think he and Charlie, worked together well. And John stays so active in the program. I mean, he's putting the shuttle crews together. I mean, he doesn't have a lot of time to be buddying around with his old crewmates. I mean, he's with the young guys. Mm-hmm. he's with the new shuttle, the new shuttle folks, and so. I think he stays friends with Charlie. Charlie continued to live down in Texas, and they must stay in contact a little bit now. I think they worked well as a crew. The one crew that is so unusual is the Apollo 11 crew. When I interviewed Mike Collins about the Apollo 11 crew, he called their crew amiable strangers. They did their jobs together well, but they never really became very well known to one another. And then I asked Mike, well, what about Neil and Buzz, just the two of them, amiable strangers? And Buzz, Mike paused for a second and said, neutral strangers. but Neil was the sort that could work with Buzz. And there was an article that appeared in a United Kingdom paper just within the last couple of days where Buzz actually commenting on Neil said, I worked with Neil, but he was kind of hard to work with, And I think what that really meant was Buzz never really understood Neil very well. There were times once my book was started that I would get a phone call myself from Aldrin, and he would want me to talk to Neil to try to convince Neil to go to some reunion or some event. And all I could say was, Buzz, you went to the moon with him. You should be able to call him yourself. But he thought, that he had a better chance if he went through me. So Buzz never really figured Neil out very well. And as for Neil figuring Buzz out, I think he figured him out only to the extent that he needed to, to get the mission accomplished.
The book is called Forever Young, A Life of Adventure in Air and Space by John W. Young, along with my guest, James R. Hansen. Dr. Hansen, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
It's my pleasure, Garrett.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. Find us on Facebook and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. I want to thank my guest, James R. Hansen. The book is called Forever Young, A Life of Adventure in Air and Space by John W. Young with James R. Hansen. And Dr. Hansen is also the author of the authorized biography of Neil Armstrong. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.